I sank my fangs into the flesh along its back. Blood filled my mouth, and I drank, pulling as much from the bear as I could manage through a randomly selected spot. It was working, albeit slowly, but the bear didn't seem to enjoy having some strange creature steal his blood. It began to lumber about, shaking roughly, trying to throw me off. I clung tight, digging my hands into the fur and gripping his skin for all I was worth. My enemy wasn't dumb and soon realized that I was too strong to simply buck off. He shifted position, lining up near a wall of the cave and rising onto his hind legs. I knew it was coming, but the first slam into the cave wall still nearly sent me sprawling to the floor. Blood loss or no, this bear had plenty of fight left in him. I could feel my back, still slightly sore from my plummet earlier that evening, bend and crackle as it was pressed against the rock. If I'd still been human, my spine would likely have been in pieces from that one blow. As it was, I drank faster, trying to compensate for the damage I was taking and tire out the bear before he could pull off too many more of those slams. The second one caused me to bite down harder, eliciting a small roar of pain from the bear. He hit with even more force on the third blow, catching me while I was adjusting my grip and nearly tumbling me to the ground. Somehow, I clung tight and kept drinking. This was all I could think of, the only way to end the fight without someone dying. To my surprise, there wasn't a fourth attempt at a slam. Instead, the bear fell back to all fours and walked forward. It took me a few seconds to realize what was happening. To be fair, I did have a lot going on at the moment, so I think it forgivable that I failed to notice that the bear was heading for the turn. Once I did, however, it all clicked. The bear couldn't shake the thing that was attacking it, so it probably wanted to run, and the only way out of the cave was back toward Deborah and Ernest. If the cave opening hadn't been blocked off, I might have tried to let the bear escape, hoping that he would just barrel past the others. But with all those rocks in the way, there was little chance the others wouldn't be caught up in the fight before the bear could get free. I couldn't permit that to happen. This was my problem to solve, my chance to prove the kind of vampire I could be. Releasing my bite, I used my handholds to pull myself up higher on the bear's back, working my way to his head. Those jaws whipped around, snapping at my arms, but between the poor angle and my exceptional reflexes, I managed to keep dodging out of the way. While this did make the job harder, it also prevented the bear from moving forward, so I was happy to deal with the inconvenience. Finally, I drew close enough, and when he next swung that snout around to try to chomp down on me, I struck the exposed side of his neck. Unlike biting down on the bear's back, I didn't have to work for blood this time. It came pounding out, the exertion of battle having substantially cranked up the bear's heart rate. He roared in anger, the sound near deafening at such close proximity, but no matter how he craned his neck, I was out of reach. A wall loomed nearby, and he slammed me into it, a powerful tactic that only succeeded in driving my fangs deeper into his flesh. When the next slam came, I noticed it was weaker than the ones before. The bear's movements were growing sluggish, too. His heart rate was starting to slow. We were nearing the point where I'd have to let go or risk killing him outright. Some part of me, the undead part that was being allowed to run more freely, wanted to keep going. It wanted to drain every last drop of this blood, inferior as it was. It wanted to never stop drinking, to roam the land and suck down all the precious blood I could find. Maybe someday that part of me would have a purpose, just as I'd discovered a use for my hunting instincts since last night. Maybe someday, but certainly not in a cave with an innocent animal who'd done nothing worse than go to sleep in his home. We were the invaders, and I didn't have the right to kill the creature just because it was in my way. Breaking off the bite, I licked the wound so he wouldn't bleed out, and then hopped off. Landing on the other side of the cave, I stood ready to react. This wasn't over until the bear was down, and I paced as it staggered about. Only when it slowly lowered itself to the ground, deep rhythmic breaths of exhaustion slipping out, did I let myself relax. Even then, I remained perched, waiting for any sudden move. It took a full 10 minutes of listening and watching before I felt sure enough to go check on Deborah and Ernest. They were right where I'd left them. Neither had moved so much as an inch. Either she'd had complete confidence in me, or wasn't at all worried about dealing with a bear if it came for her. Probably the latter, if I was being honest with myself. "It's done," I told her, well aware she'd just heard the whole thing play out. I noticed. Not bad, Fred. Sloppy and untrained, but what else should I expect from someone without practice? Still, there's no arguing with results, and you certainly got the job done. And without killing. I wasn't sure why I felt the need to add something so obvious, other than that the words surged up from within me. Perhaps having to accept some aspects of what it meant to be a vampire was making me more determined to define the lines I still refused to cross. Or maybe I simply wanted her to know the kind of solutions I would always choose, even if other options were available. To my surprise, she gave a gentle smile in response. "Yes, without killing. Mercy is a fine thing when appropriate. But as we wait for the sun to set, I want you to consider this. What would you have done in the same situation if I hadn't taught you how to properly feed? Would knowing less, being weaker, have allowed you to find a safer outcome? Or is it only through owning your power and having your true options available that you found a way to show mercy? While you're at it, imagine how much different that fight would have been if you were working with my level of... no, maybe just Lillian's level of strength. Something to dwell on while we pass the time." It wasn't exactly resounding praise, but she also wasn't pronouncing my failure. In situations like these, I resolved it was better to look on the bright side, while I still could. 8. It may not surprise you, dear listener, but after doing battle with a grumpy bear, the remainder of my adventure posed a comparatively minor challenge. When night fell, Deborah and I both made a run for it. Her car might have been around still, though she struck me as too calculating to leave such a thing to chance, but it also could have been towed away during the day. Rather than backtrack for a potential vehicle, I opted to trust in my own legs, which were feeling especially light after the glut of bear blood I'd swallowed. Less nutritious than human blood or not, I'd still had to down quite a bit to knock out the bear, and the effects of a full stomach were showing. Part of me wanted to pause and ask about where the blood actually went, since I was sure I'd consumed more than my stomach should be able to physically hold. Instead, I kept my focus on the task at hand, getting home. Even with a body topped off on blood, it was still a long trek back to town, and even farther to Charlotte Manor. As it turned out, though, we didn't have to go quite that far. Roughly a mile before we would have needed to leave the back roads and run along the highway, Deborah and I found our path blocked by a large SUV, a familiar pickup truck, and what looked like an El Camino with a paint job that shifted as I stared at it. No sooner had we paused to assess the vehicles than floodlights snapped on and doors were kicked open, footsteps flooding the night with sound.
"Fred, are you okay?"
I knew that voice. Looking up, blinking away the harsh light, I could make out a silhouette I'd recognize anywhere, After all, we'd worked together for some time when he was my assistant. Albert, why are you here? And why are you blinding us?
Precaution. Vampires can't be harmed by bright lights, but it trips their instinctual fear and clouds their judgment. We weren't sure if we'd find you and Deborah, or just Deborah.
The voice gave away its owner's identity as much as the cigarette smoke rising over the lights.
Since you're safe, I guess we'll extinguish these for now.
The lights died, revealing Albert and Arch, as I'd deduced, along with Amy, Bubba, Neil, and Lillian, all of whom were staring at me with concern. Deborah stepped up to my side, Ernest still cradled in her arms.
How sweet! They thought I'd murdered you and came out to seek revenge.
Don't be silly. That would be illegal, Arch corrected. We're here because the head of a clan went missing during the daytime, and his people were concerned. Amy proposed she whip up a tracking spell, and I saw an excellent opportunity to train my charges in the art of hunting down a target. Our goal was always to find Fred and ensure his safe return.
A glimmer of a smile danced like a passing shadow on Deborah's face, then vanished just as fast.
Time has allowed you to hone many skills, Agent, but don't forget which of us has had more of that resource. For the sake of convenience, I will choose to believe you. Just remember, if I do decide to kill this man, I will be perfectly within my rights to do so. If you move against the Blood Council for retribution, you do so without the weight of the agency behind you.
Which is exactly why we were looking for Fred, not you, Arch countered.
There was a strange tension between these two, something like respect and enmity. For the first time, I wondered who between them was actually the more powerful, Deborah or an agent like Arch or Crystal. Despite all her strength, Deborah had set up this assessment in a way that ensured she wouldn't have to fight them. From someone else, I might have assumed that meant she was weaker, but Deborah probably would have taken the same precautions even if the enemy was as comparatively defenseless as I was. She took zero unnecessary risks. While those two were busy sniping at each other, the others ran over to me. Their worry was touching, but it had a better target than me at the moment.
Bubba, Amy, I need your help. I was learning to hunt, and I accidentally injured a wolf in my first try. I'm assuming one of you knows something about treating this sort of wound, or has connections to someone who would?
Gently, I took Ernest from Deborah and handed him off into the thick arms of Bubba, who cradled the wolf like it was made from glass.
This feller looks rough. Busted leg, maybe some bruised ribs, judging from the breathing. He's got a good amount of recovery in front of him, but if we stay on top of things, he should live.
Thank goodness. I let out a sigh of relief. I hadn't known if we were actually saving the poor creature's life or merely prolonging its suffering, so it was welcome news to hear Bubba's diagnosis.
Don't it figure? We come all the way out to save you, and you're out here hauling around a wounded animal because you feel guilty for feeding on it.
Bubba stopped, looking up from Ernest to lock his gaze on me, his eyes narrowing.
Hang on. This was your first feed? You mean first feed of the night, right? I know you buy most of your blood, but you must have sipped off someone alive before.
I cast my mind back through the years, just to be sure I wasn't misremembering anything. I had to bite Quinn at the safe house, but that doesn't really count as feeding, and I took a drop or two from people here and there. Never right from the vein, though. My tongue nearly slipped and announced that I'd had a drop of blood directly from Gideon. Deborah might very well already know that, as she certainly seemed dialed in on my life. However, that was no reason to draw attention to the incident, especially since that was part of the events that had led to my silver immunity.
For his part, Bubba seemed far less concerned with the shift in words and more with what I was actually trying to say.
So, this wolf was the first time you tried to drink straight from another creature's veins? You must have been starting with a full belly then, right?
I was famished, actually, I admitted. Part of the training required wearing me out first. Does this influence the treatment of Ernest? Amy snickered from her place at Bubba's side. You named the... No, never mind. Why am I surprised? That's a silly thing to be surprised over, especially with you. She leaned down and looked into both the wolf's eyes, eliciting a strange whimper from Ernest's throat. Apparently, he saw something in her gaze he wasn't sure of. No, the more impressive feat is that this wolf is alive at all. Pretty much every vampire kills their first prey. Between the instincts and the thirst, they don't know when to stop. It's part of the reason why new vampires are especially dangerous. Fred had something of an advantage, Deborah pointed out, letting things with Arch settle and joining our conversation at last. He's much older than most vampires when they first feed. Fred has had years to learn at least some self-control, rather than just days. We also worked with animals, whose blood lacks the intoxicating flavor of a human's, and is therefore easier to stop drinking. Still, I can admit achievement when I see it, and Fred did display an especially strong will when it came to holding himself back. Self-denial is arguably the most powerful aspect of his personality. It was hard to parse how much of that was a compliment and how much was a backhanded insult, so I didn't try to unknot it. We'd been out here for a long time, and I was more than ready to head back home. First things first, though, I went through a brief procession of hugs, or a handshake in Neil's case, and reassured everyone that I was okay. I didn't particularly lie for Deborah, but I framed the whole incident as what it had been, a lesson. Yes, it was one where my life had been on the line, yet it was a lesson all the same. Deborah had promised to educate me, and I couldn't honestly say she hadn't. Our day out had taught me a tremendous amount, both in what it meant to be a vampire and on the methods I was using to lead my clan. I wasn't quite ready to start downing dragon blood or hunting Therians, but I also couldn't deny that some of what she'd said held weight. I'd been able to show that bear mercy because I knew how to stop it without resorting to murder or breaking limbs. Power in itself didn't make someone deadly. It was how that power was applied that mattered. My entire group of friends had been living examples of that for as long as I'd known them, and I'd been too dense to notice. Eventually, it was time to head back. As the others worked to load Ernest carefully into the back of Arch's SUV, Deborah sidled up next to me. While it was hard to know what to expect from her at any given moment, I had a hunch she wasn't going to try to murder me with this many allies close at hand. Do you remember what I said earlier, Fred? Systems fail, countries fall, and in the end, all you can rely on is yourself. I'd like to make an amendment to that. You should also be able to count on your clan. That's why we started forming them back in the beginning, so we could have other ageless beings in our life, people who understood what it was to walk the world eternally. Not every clan lives up to that ideal. In fact, these days, relatively few can even begin to approach it. The House of Fred, however, came for you within hours of your disappearance, ready to fight a member of the Blood Council if they had to. Whatever else I determine about you as an individual, I want you to know that I hold your clan in high esteem. I wish more of our leaders could inspire such loyalty. The words were kind and meant more to me than I'd have expected, but I also knew that Deborah was wrong. It wasn't me who inspired that loyalty. We'd have all done the same for any of our friends that had suddenly gone missing. I wasn't an exceptional leader. I'd simply made friends with exceptionally good people. I lacked the energy for that kind of discussion, though. The weight of everything I'd gone through in the last day felt like it had landed roughly on my shoulders. Giving a perfunctory nod in acknowledgement, I made my way over to the pickup. Deborah, I noticed, had chosen to ride in the back of the SUV with Ernest. As Bubba's truck roared to life, I dearly wished I had the ability to sleep at night. A good nap would have allowed me to put some mental distance between myself and everything that had happened. Nocturnal hours were part of being a vampire, though, and if the last 24 hours had taught me nothing else, it had certainly shown me how much of a vampire I really was. An Issue in Escrow. 1. It was the knock that signaled that my night would take an unexpected turn. After our fight with the murderous Mage Kevin and a day hiding in the woods to tap into my baser instincts, life had somewhat settled down. In my line of work, things were never completely peaceful, of course, and while I did have to deal with a new client who lived in a ring of trees surrounding a lake, as well as settle a budget dispute between two feuding ogres who co-ran a construction business, those cases were resolved without much fuss. In truth, outside of odd locations and appearances, they may as well have been normal accounting work. I'd even heard from Crystal a few times. I wasn't sure where she was or what she was doing. The whole thing was being treated with the utmost discretion, although I got the sense that she was on some sort of magical quest. Whatever tasks the Fae had charged her with clearly weren't easy or quickly resolved, but she seemed to be enjoying herself. For people like Crystal and June, this was probably the equivalent of an adventurous vacation, much like mountain climbing might be to more mundane folks. In other words, the sort of vacation I tended to avoid as skillfully as possible. The night of the portentous knock, Crystal was on my mind. We'd gotten to speak earlier in the day, and I had a sense that things might be wrapping up for her soon. All thoughts of my fiancée fled from my brain at the sound of that knock, however. Why was a knock such a big deal? Simple, because no one knocked on the front door of Charlotte Manor. She was a bed and breakfast, as far as strangers knew, which would be the equivalent of knocking at a hotel. Of course, many in the parahuman world were in on Charlotte's secret, but all of them would either know to just walk in, or were keenly aware of how unwelcome they would be within her walls. While there was a small chance it might be a devoted magazine salesman pushing his work well into the evening, the odds were staggeringly in favor of parahuman shenanigans. Lest you think me paranoid, I was not the only resident to reach such a conclusion. From the parlor, Lillian and Arch emerged. They sometimes liked to sit and chat about centuries past. I still wasn't sure how old either of them were, despite having listened in a few times. The best I could manage to deduce was that both had been alive during the tail end of the 1800s. Beyond that, it was anyone's guess. Arch held up a hand, stopping me from advancing further down the stairs, and drew a gun from within the unassuming folds of his clothing. He peeked through a window, then looked upward toward the ceiling.
"Charlotte, we've got a man in a business suit on your porch. No telltale parahuman traits. Can you give me any further information?"
"He's shown no supernatural abilities since arriving here." The version of Charlotte that wore the dated dress, the one I tended to think of as her default form, appeared behind Arch. He drove up, emerged from his car, walked to the door, and knocked. I can detect trace amounts of magic now that he's close. However, it's a spell designed to cloak other magic, so that may not be helpful.
"More helpful than you think. Fred, where's your bodyguard?" Arch asked.
A pale blur raced down the stairs, halting at my side.
"I'm here, I'm here. Boring stuff for weeks, and the minute I try to relax in a bath, something interesting has to happen."
Deborah was clad in sweatpants, a t-shirt, and a shockingly fluffy robe, her hair wrapped up tightly in a perfectly twisted towel. For having just leapt from the bath, she'd put herself together quite well. Checking his gun, Arch shifted his posture so the weapon would be concealed behind his back, and then opened the door.
"Can I help you?"
From my position near a window, I could just make out the figure bowing stiffly outside. When he spoke, his voice had a slight accent to it, though not from any region I could readily place.
"I have come to seek the services of Frederick Frankfurt Fletcher, on behalf of He Who Is Mighty, the Scion of the Skies, the Slayer of Actragon, the—"
"You're here for Gideon. I recognize the titles."
Arch didn't quite ease the grip on his gun just yet. This was strange. If Gideon wanted something, he could have called himself, or used someone like Bubba as a go-between. We had mutual friends. Why would he reach out using a stranger? The simplest answer was that he wouldn't, and it was a trick. But the mere fact that Arch hadn't shot this man signaled that there was a reasonable chance he was telling the truth. At the sound of Gideon's name, our visitor startled, then bowed again for no reason I could discern.
"Yes, I have come at the command of our glorious King of the West. In his infinite wisdom he has laid this task upon me, that I might find Frederick Frankfurt Fletcher and deliver unto him the great dragon's business proposal."
Without leaving his post at the door, Arch angled an eye in my direction, silently inquiring if I knew anything about this. I gave a shrug. It was news to me. Then again, if this man was here to discuss a proposal, I obviously wouldn't be clued in as of yet. That was the point of business proposals, to bring others on board.
"Did Gideon give you any sort of proof?" Arch asked. "You'll understand if we're cautious. You wouldn't be the first one to use a famous person's name for your own means."
"Of course."
Hurrying, the man reached into his suit jacket pocket, a motion that made Arch's gun twitch, and produced a sheet of paper that he handed over. Arch scanned the page once, then gave it to Lillian and nodded in my direction. She brought it over for me to read, though it almost wasn't necessary. The moment I saw that it was written in crayon, I knew that it was real. What forger in the world, even one aware of Gideon's situation, would think to write a note from one of the most powerful creatures in the world using crayon? It was the sort of casual display of indifference and power that served as Gideon's true signature. Still, I perused the note. There was no such thing as being too thorough. It read, "Fred, if you're reading this, I assume the lackey I sent made it to you in one piece. The formality is a necessary evil this time, since what I'm doing requires that I put everything through official channels. I won't say more here, lest the note fall into the wrong hands, but knowing your friends, I assumed they would demand proof this is all really from me. Unlike that day in the cage, you're the one in charge now. Listen to the proposal and make your decision." If I'd had any lingering doubts, his mention of the cage confirmed that the note had truly been authored by Gideon. Only he and I knew what had happened inside the magical structure another dragon had built to imprison the King of the West. He'd poured his magic through me, using me like a puppet to break the enchantments, and had fundamentally altered me in the process, to say the least. After all, it was that experience which had left me immune to silver. "It's Gideon," I declared, tucking the note away in my pocket. I would burn it later, just to be safe. The less said about the incident with the cage, the better. "Let him in. Charlotte, can we use the dining room for a meeting?"
"Certainly. Dinner isn't for another hour, and I can push it back as needed. I'll prepare some light snacks and finger sandwiches in the meantime."
Charlotte vanished, or rather, her human avatar did. The real Charlotte rarely moved, save for when she felt like rearranging her structure. I stepped over to the door, taking Arch's spot as he slipped out of view, Deborah right on my heels. "Hello there. I'm Frederick Frankfurt Fletcher. May I ask your name?"
"I am Gadsper, loyal servant of the King of the West and the emissary trusted with his missive to you."
Gadsper bowed again. From this angle, I could detect a slight bulge on the back of his suit jacket, right around the shoulder blades. The glimpse was too brief to figure out what the lump was, and besides, it was rude to stare. "Gadsper, why don't you come in, and we'll show you to the dining room. I'm very curious to see what made the King of the West send you over." Using Gideon's formal title wasn't something we generally did, but today I'd make an exception, partially because Gadsper seemed more comfortable speaking about the dragon in formal terms, but also for the sake of Deborah. Though she knew that we were connected, I much preferred her to think my relationship with Gideon was purely business. The fact that we were, well, not quite friends, but closer to it than most outsiders would guess, could complicate things. The less familiar we seemed with the King of the West, the better. I just had to hope that whatever business he wanted wouldn't nullify that perception beyond repair.
2. The Jewel of Temecula.
I read the words again, something familiar wiggling in my brain. "I know that word. Isn't that a town in Alabama?" Lillian shook her head.
"That's Tuscaloosa. Temecula is in California." "Yes, this job is only for the Jewel of Temecula. The scepter of Tuscaloosa has yet to be found, as it was stolen 30 years ago."
Gadsper's explanation served only to leave me with more questions, but I put them aside for the moment. There was business to attend to. After sitting down in Charlotte's dining room, Gadsper had opened his briefcase to reveal a lot of documents. Not quite the thrilling revelation I'm sure the others were hoping for, but I considered it a welcome sight. I'd half expected a small dragon to pop out of there, or perhaps a magical blade we were supposed to sink into some evil creature's chest. Instead, I got exactly what Gadsper had promised, a business proposal. The deal was relatively straightforward. Gideon wanted to hire Fletcher Accounting Services to act as an escrow holder for a deal he was in the process of making. Apparently, he'd located an item for sale that he desired to purchase. Unfortunately, neither he nor the seller fully trusted one another. As a neutral business entity, we would take possession of the Jewel of Temecula upon Gideon issuing a deposit for half its cost. After that, we would bring it to Gideon, at which time he would make the rest of the payment. I was tempted to ask why he didn't go fetch it himself, but I already suspected the answer. Part of it would be for image. A mighty dragon was hardly expected to run his own errands. On top of that, however, it was likely a safety precaution. When Gideon used his power, he wasn't known for being gentle. If something went awry and he had to fight to truly do battle, then anyone or anything nearby could easily be engulfed in the damage. The one time he'd been encouraged to let loose was against a fellow dragon, and the only reason the site of that encounter had not been destroyed was because Sally was within its walls. Without Richard's daughter to temper his fury, there was quite literally no telling how much havoc Gideon could wreak. "The proposal is straightforward, and the terms are generous." I was underselling it quite a bit. If these were the terms Gideon would pay merely for delivery, then I didn't want to imagine what he might be shelling out for the item. However, I do have one central concern about this job. Why me? Or rather, why my company? Surely Gideon has contacts with more experience at this sort of thing. So why is he paying a firm with no history in such work? Gadsper didn't seem perplexed by my query. He didn't even fidget. Now that I was paying attention, I realized that Gadsper barely seemed to move at all, unless he was speaking. When he did shift, his motions were stiff, deliberate, as if he took constant and great care. The Jewel of Temecula is an item of great might, with many powers, but not all of them are desirable. One aspect of its magic is an aura of temptation that draws all living sentient beings to use it. Normal humans lose control of themselves, try to steal the jewel and wield its power for themselves. Anyone without proper magical training would, of course, be incinerated by such magic, yet the person would still try to use it even if they'd witnessed the destruction. Beings of great willpower and intellect, such as the King of the West, can resist this temptation, though it is impossible for most mortals. As a member of the undead, your kind are not susceptible to the jewel's temptation, Mr. Fletcher. That is why your company was chosen. Not quite the explanation I'd have predicted, but it did make sense. If Gideon needed a company he could trust, who also happened to be staffed by the undead, then Fletcher Accounting Services fit the bill. Technically speaking, we had yet to employ anyone other than undead Americans. Lillian and I were both vampires, and Albert was a zombie. I was concerned about the notion of taking Gideon's task while being observed by Deborah, though. While she was as nice as one charged with determining my life or death could reasonably be, I wanted to keep her as far from Gideon as possible. The closer she got, the greater the risk my secret would come out. Unfortunately, I also couldn't risk turning the job down. Even setting aside the fact that denying Gideon a favor was a dangerous position to take, I felt obligated to accept. If the Jewel of Temecula was so powerful that Gideon not only wanted it, but was willing to jump through all these hoops, then it wasn't something I wanted to see turned loose upon my city. Another company might be willing to take the job, but they wouldn't have a member of the Blood Council with them. Should something go awry, and dealing with Gideon, it was best to assume it would, then Deborah had a better chance of fighting off whatever challenges we might face than nearly any other parahuman in the city. Her presence was no doubt part of why Gideon had contacted me to do this. He knew she was here, and he knew she was powerful. To use my situation to his advantage, well, that kind of cunning was exactly what dragons were known for. "Does the client have any limits on how many of us can facilitate the transfer?" I asked. As a team, this might be doable, but if the seller wanted me to come alone, we'd have an issue.
"While they did not specify a body limit, they will be expecting only a single vehicle," Gadsper explained. "So long as your team does not exceed that, I cannot see why there would be any objections. Safe delivery of the merchandise benefits all who are involved."
One vehicle. That was actually more generous than I'd hoped for. Assuming we borrowed an SUV from Arch, we could convey up to 6 people comfortably. We likely wouldn't even need that many, since the only vampires here were Deborah, Lillian, and myself.
"We can work with that. When does the client want to meet?"
"Midnight."
Gadsper managed to look a touch sheepish, as though even he knew how cliched that time choice was.
"Right, but midnight on what date?"
"This one. Tonight."
Gadsper tapped his hand on the table, as though he worried we wouldn't get the meaning from his words.
"The Jewel of Temecula will draw many interested parties once it is in the open. It is being brought to Colorado right now, and from the moment it arrives until it is in the hand of the King of the West, it is in danger. The faster the transfer is done, the safer the situation will be. And so the Great One has released information to no one until tonight, the evening of the transaction."
That was cutting things tight. My schedule for the evening wasn't crammed, but there were things to do. Still, I could shuffle my plans as needed for a task this important. It would have been rude not to check with the others, though. "Lillian, Deborah, do either of you have issues with doing this tonight?"
"I can make it work," Lillian replied.
I go where you go, Deborah added. To my surprise, Arch checked his watch and grumbled something that sounded like satisfaction.
You said midnight? Good. Based on the meeting location, that should give him enough time to get here before you need to head out.
All eyes turned to the agent, who looked up expectantly, fully aware that we'd be staring.
I'm sending Albert with you. He and Neil have been doing a lot of training under me, but there's no substitute for actual field experience. Although they're a team, there will be times when they get separated or have to tackle separate challenges, so this is an excellent chance for Albert to get more experience under his belt. Unless there's a reason you wouldn't want a weapon of destiny at your side during this job.
It was strange to picture Albert, the Albert I'd known and worked with for years, as anything other than my cheerful assistant, but he'd been diligently working with Arch since leaving my employ, and it would be silly to assume he hadn't grown or changed in all that time. True, he still seemed like the same old Albert when he was in Charlotte Manor. However, I'd been with Crystal long enough to know that there was a difference between being at home and being in the field. Agents and those training alongside them let different parts of their personality show depending on the situation. No objections from me. Albert is a trusted friend and is always welcome. I hope we won't need that sword, though. As he pulled out his phone, Arch chuckled darkly under his breath.
I remember when I was still naive enough to have hope.
3. Our few hours of preparation time flew past. In what seemed like mere moments, we were piling into one of the rotating SUVs Arch seemed to keep around for agency business. Deborah insisted on driving, and no one tried to fight her for the opportunity. I took the passenger seat in case anyone was watching for me in particular to make sure we were who they'd been expecting. That might seem like a stretch, but if the seller knew the name of the company Gideon was sending, then one quick search online would turn up general information about me, including pictures. I figured it was best to err on the side of caution. Besides, Albert needed the extra space in the back seat, given that he had a sword resting in his lap. My former assistant had shown up roughly 15 minutes before it was time to depart, and despite the fact that it had only been a few weeks since we last saw one another, I almost didn't recognize him. As I said earlier, zombies don't change naturally. They're animated corpses and therefore done with things like aging and growth. However, a skilled necromancer could use their magic for bodily alterations on corpses, dead or undead, as necessary. And when I caught sight of the slight widening of Albert's shoulders, I suspected that Neil had been helping him add muscle. That wasn't what made Albert look so different, though. No, that honor went to the twin shifts in his hair and wardrobe. Gone was his shoulder-length hair. Albert had trimmed his mane into the bedhead-looking mess that was popular these days. Less to grab in a fight, I presumed. He'd also traded in his usual ensemble of jeans and a t-shirt for dark, functional clothes, a few charms that glittered with an odd sheen, and some protective gear here and there. It wasn't how he dressed when we were hanging around Charlotte Manor, but then again, this wasn't a night of leisure. We had a job to do. Thankfully, the physical shifts seemed to be the most major changes in Albert. He still greeted everyone cheerfully and had his usual grin slapped into place. The only behavioral difference I could spot was that he moved with more grace and more carefully than he had before. Not a bad change, to be certain, but still one that I took careful note of. As the leader of his clan and a friend, it was my responsibility to keep an eye on Albert. So long as he was happy with his life's new direction, I wouldn't intervene. That was what mattered most. If ever that stopped being true, I needed to be ready to help guide him in a direction that would suit the man he was now, not the man I remembered my assistant being. Conversation in the car was sparse. There wasn't much to say at this point. We were going in with all the information we had, and until we arrived, there wouldn't be anything new. Mostly we listened to the radio and stared out the windows. All of us felt the impact of our keyed-up nerves, though we had no reason to be scared yet. If someone was going to try to attack or rob us, it wouldn't make sense to do so until after we had the Jewel of Temecula. Unless a criminal was planning to impersonate us, which honestly just seemed like far more trouble than it would be worth, especially if they were already strong enough to deal with two accountant vampires, a member of the Blood Council, and a zombie wielding a weapon of destiny, then there would be no reason to not just wait until we had the item, and then kill us.
Hey guys, before we get there, and I'm sorry if this is a silly question, but why do they call it the Jewel of Temecula?
Albert piped up from the back seat as we exited the highway and approached our destination. It wasn't a silly question at all. I'd been wondering the same thing since hearing the name, but since it didn't apply directly to the job, I'd been holding off on my curiosity until we made the delivery to Gideon, expecting that only he would have the answer. As it turned out, I had underestimated my bodyguard. When America was founded, it wasn't just humans who rushed to explore and conquer as many parts of it as possible. Parahumans were here too, remember, and we went to work uncovering lost or hidden artifacts that had been squirreled away throughout the millennia. Some of the items found were complete mysteries, all knowledge of them or their creators lost in the sands of time. For those, the discoverers generally named the items after the locations where they were found. Thus, a gem found in the Temecula Valley became the Jewel of Temecula.
"Doesn't tell us much about what it does," Lillian noted. "I've always thought that was part of why they used that naming convention. Fewer people will try to steal a Jewel of Temecula than the Gem of Mind Control, or the Orb of Endless Money, or whatever magic this one houses."
A slight rattle from the back announced that Albert had adjusted his position, shifting the sword.
"Huh. So the Blade of the Unlikely Champion isn't the only arcane object with a super vague name."
He shook his head ruefully.
"I've spent the last couple of years trying to understand what the heck that title is even supposed to mean, and have gotten nowhere. There are just too many potential interpretations."
"Telling you something that leaves you knowing less than you did before sounds to me like a mage named that weapon."
There was a slight edge to Deborah's voice with that comment, although it could have been because we were drawing near to the address we'd been given. The location didn't look like much, an old warehouse with a stone wall and a steel gate to keep trespassers out. Only when we drew close did I catch the small details that marked recent renovation. A patch in the wall here, new hinges there, all tiny giveaways that this place wasn't as derelict as it might seem. As our vehicle drew close to the gate, someone stepped out from behind the wall, flashlight in hand. They were clothed in a black ensemble, complete with a ski mask to obscure their face. The beam of light came through the windshield, stopping on first Deborah, then me, before clicking off completely. The stranger stepped back out of view, and seconds later, the gate began to slowly part down the middle. We took the cue and drove forward, guided into one of the warehouses by the flashlight of our gatekeeper. As we pulled in, the doors sealed shut behind us, and more bodies came into view. There were at least a dozen people here, all of them dressed in dark tactical clothing and built like they could find their way to the gym while blindfolded. They waited tensely as we piled out of the SUV one by one. I half expected someone to make noise about Albert's sword, but, curiously, not a single person mentioned it. Perhaps they were expecting those of us who would transport such an item to be armed, or maybe Neil had worked some magic to keep the weapon from drawing too much attention. Whatever the cause, no one said a word as we slowly exited the vehicle. Only when we were all out did a voice finally rise.
"Frederick Frankfurt Fletcher, of Fletcher Accounting Services. You are prompt. I respect that. You may call me Sebastian.
The fellow who spoke had been tucked away behind some old boxes, and unlike the others, his ensemble boasted a bit of flair. A charcoal-gray suit was wrapped around a bright emerald shirt and adorned with a matching pocket square, topped off by a smiling face with just enough laugh lines to denote experience. The salt-and-pepper temples helped the impression as well. His most important feature, though, was the briefcase clutched firmly in his right hand. At Fletcher Accounting Services, we strive for precision in all things. Punctuality is just one aspect of that. May I presume that case is our package?
You may.
Sebastian walked across the cracked concrete floor, coming right up to me, and held the case aloft.
Do not open it unless there is a dire need. This case has been specially crafted to shield and hide the Jewel of Temecula. It cannot recreate the wardings of a vault designed for such a purpose, but it will at least ensure that every mage in the state does not suddenly sense a spike in magical power.
Standing a few feet away from us, Deborah piped up.
It is customary to inspect the goods one is being charged with delivering prior to taking possession of them.
Sebastian glanced over at her and did a double take.
My goodness! What is the prudence of the Blood Council doing here? Gideon truly went all out on security, I must say.
That caught me off guard, but there was no time to interpret or ask for an explanation, as Sebastian was already responding to a different question.
On this occasion, the case is the package. Right now, four other people are handing off four identical cases to other teams within the city. Only I and Gideon know which one is the real vessel. If you'll recall your hiring documents, there should have been mention of increased security procedures. Call him if you'd like, but he'll merely be annoyed by the interruption. This is the delivery we've arranged. You can open the case if you want. Just be prepared for the consequences, if what it contains is, as they say, the real deal.
I reached out and accepted the briefcase from Sebastian's outstretched hand. That's quite all right. I don't see any reason to compromise Gideon's security. If there's an issue, we all know that Gideon is more than capable of sorting it out and ensuring whoever is at fault is held accountable. It was a threat, albeit a small one. Sebastian surely knew that if he tried to swindle the King of the West, there would be dire consequences. If he was desperate enough to take that gamble, then no amount of poking around from us would change his mind. Better to accept the job as it was, get clear of here, make the delivery, and allow Gideon to deal with any problems in his own way. We were only contracted to handle the escrow, and I did not intend to let us be pulled in any deeper.
Go ahead and load that up, but we can't let you leave until...
Sebastian was cut off by a ding from his pocket. He pulled out a phone and looked it over, muttering in some language I'd never heard before. From the tone, it sounded like a whispered vulgarity.
I swear he does that on purpose. I just don't yet know how. Good news. The first half of the payment has gone through, so you are free to leave. Get that to Gideon so I can have the rest of my money and be out of this town. Oh, and before I forget...
Sebastian snapped his fingers, summoning a flash of emerald green fire and smoke that cleared away to reveal a crisp white business card.
If you should ever need anything not freely available, be it goods, information, or other, do feel free to give me a call. Sebastian Selkirk, Acquisitions Specialist Extraordinaire.
He didn't wait for me to respond or offer my card in return. Sebastian was already walking away by the time I looked up. It was for the best, anyway. Now that the clock had started, I was more than ready to get out of here. With luck and good traffic, we could be at Gideon's within a half hour. The sooner this briefcase was out of my hands, the better. My team piled into the SUV. Deborah fired up the engine and gunned us back out through the gate with exceptional skill I hadn't expected. As she accelerated toward the highway, I laid a careful hand on her shoulder. "Don't speed. Don't draw attention to us in any way whatsoever." She didn't dismiss the suggestion outright, though her face grew skeptical. "Given that there are 5 potential targets out there, and the real one is presumably shielded, I'd say speed is our best bet. If we can make it there before we get targeted, then we minimize all other risks. I've got the reflexes to outdrive any cop or potential accident we might encounter." "That would be a good point, except that we can't afford to take even that minor of a risk. The other 4 briefcases are fakes." I gently patted the leather-covered rectangle resting in my lap. "There is absolutely no doubt in my mind that Gideon gave us the real package." 4. No one was sold right away, but Deborah did agree to drive more conservatively until I fully explained myself. As we cruised toward the highway, I laid out the steps to what, from the outside, must have seemed like quite a wild leap of logic. "It's a lot of smaller factors linked together that gives it away. For example, we know Gideon needs someone really powerful, willful, or undead to not be tempted by the Jewel of Temecula, right? Well, Gideon doesn't strike me as the type to casually trust the power or will of non-dragons. That means he would most likely use undead for the deliveries. Aside from us, the only other local vampires are the Turvas. So either he used a clan he doesn't trust, or he brought in outside help, the kind that someone might notice when they suddenly showed up in town. Our team is the most low-key, trustworthy, and local option he has. Plus, based on what most people know about our company, we're the weakest. Trusting strong enemies to overlook seemingly powerless foes strikes me as a very Gideon kind of move." Lillian piped up from the back. "Fred raises an interesting point. The man who handed off the briefcase to us wasn't undead. We could all tell that much for sure. So either we got a fake, or Sebastian was powerful enough to resist the magical temptation all on his own. Deborah, do you have any insight on that?" "He recognized me, but called me by my title rather than my name. That suggests he's old, if nothing else. I haven't publicly worked under my professional persona in quite some time. I've heard whispers of his acquisitions business before, but we've never dealt in person. Based on the way he carried himself and his scent, yes, I suspect Sebastian might very well have been capable of dealing with the Jewel of Temecula, at least in a warded case, and for the short time that transaction required." Deborah slapped the horn as a sedan suddenly tried to merge into our lane with neither warning nor signal. She refused to yield. For a moment, the sedan kept moving. Only upon the realization that she had no intent to move did it return to its own lane. I really hoped this vehicle had some sort of armor or reinforcement. Otherwise, Deborah was being very cavalier with our transportation.
"That does give Fred's theory weight," Albert chimed in. "If someone important made our drop, then it's more likely we have the real gem."
Much as I wanted to take the help, I unfortunately had to bring up all relevant information. "Assuming we actually met with Sebastian, it might have been an illusion or some other kind of magic for all we know." "No, he was real. You'd have spotted some of the telltale signs if he wasn't. We've both still got mage blood in us. Even though it's faded, you should still be able to see magic. Did you not notice the sheen on some of Albert's accessories?" Deborah never took her eyes off the road, but made to nod at the back seat, which resulted in some brief but humorous contortion. "Those are enchantments. We'd presumably see it from the briefcase as well, except for the fact that the enchantments placed upon it are built around hiding the presence of magic. Point is,
We definitely got the real Sebastian, which means you might be correct about... Do you hear that?
As Deborah trailed off, I listened harder to the world around us, instantly picking up on the noise she'd mentioned. There was no mistaking the sound of a helicopter flying through the sky. Normally I would have presumed someone rich was doing a tour of Winslow, or that a local hiker was being rushed to the hospital. I lacked such optimism tonight, and as I caught sight of the distant spinning blades against the dark night sky through the windshield, my hopes slipped even lower. I was never one to study vehicles with passion, military ones even less so, yet even I could tell the difference between a recreational helicopter and one designed for war. The chopper was black, sleek, and carried visible guns on both sides. I could only see it from so far off, thanks to my vampire senses, but at the pace it was moving, it didn't seem like it would take long to catch us. Anyone here with some historical knowledge know if the Jewel of Temecula is especially sturdy? I asked.